Welcome to the Cloquet Vineyard. To find out more of who we are, go to cloquetvineyard.org. Thanks for listening and have a good and beautiful day.
All right, we're continuing our series called Pause. We're in the Lenten part of in our spiritual rhythms. Lent is a tradition that's been being practiced for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. It really started when people wanted to get baptized. They'd get baptized on Easter as a way to identify with Christ, with new life. And so they would, in the same way Jesus went into the desert for 40 days to prepare for his ministry and his life, they took 40 days of pausing. 40 days of getting low, of slowing down, of denying themselves on purpose some of the things that they maybe liked or enjoyed, as a way of saying, I'm going to direct all my energy, all my heart, all my movement towards the person of Jesus. And then over the years, it continued to evolve where now, maybe, you might, did you guys ever celebrate Lent when maybe you're a kid? Anybody? And you like had to like, your dad would say, you're not eating chocolate for 6 weeks. You're like, oh, dad, what's wrong with chocolate? He's like, don't talk back to me. That was my dad, so. Yeah. And it can be viewed as like a punishment, right? Like, you don't deserve this, and all you get is fish on Friday nights, all right? Oh, thanks, Jesus. So, but really it's meant to pause us, where we can maybe willingly give up some things as a way for us to suffer, right, with Christ. Like, I'm not on Twitter and some things on my phone. Like, I'm, yes, all for you, Lord. It's such a suffer. I don't know what Trump is tweeting, but it's for you, right? But there's something healthy. Like, we can go 1,000 miles per hour. We can barrel through, wake up on Easter Sunday as a Jesus-looking person and say, oh, yeah, it's Easter. Get the big hat on. High fives. Let's have a ham, right? And there's a deep, rich experience about Easter through the person of Jesus, not just back then, it's like there's a cute story, and not just when we die and we go to heaven, but like now, in this moment. And if we don't pause, then I think it's easy to miss out on it. And so when you pause, you can ask really hard questions like this one. It's really hard to not love really cute things, right? Do you notice that there's just some things you're predisposed that you just like? And I would say maybe for like a large group of people, there's some things that we can just generally say that we really like. For example, is the curling team for USA, right? Yeah, you are really excited, Anna McFarland. I knew that was you, right? And like, we got a picture of him? Yeah, look at, like, how can you not love this guy? You gotta love them. I heard someone said it's like a group of dads that went away a weekend getaway and then ended up at a curling tournament and said, well, why not, right? And I've never heard anyone, when they talked about curling, never have heard anyone talk about, especially these guys, say, I just want to punch him in the face. I want to, right in that big fat mustache, I'm going to punch him in the face, right? I've never heard anyone say, oh, they're such jerks. Everyone I've talked to are like, wow, just love, feel like they're like my family, like they're brothers, right? Second one is this. I've never heard anyone complain about puppies in a mug. Not once. All right? Just, exactly. You just can't, like, no one's going to look in and say, oh, just throw it away. We don't need that. All right? No one. So there's just some things that you just, your heart goes to. But if that's true, then maybe the opposite is true as well. Maybe there's some things that we don't know why, we just don't like them. Like, example number one, the Yankees. All right? No one likes the Yankees. It's true. No one likes them. And why? Because they have a value system. They have like this code of where you have to have your hair cut a certain way and you have to be beautiful and chiseled and athletic, all right? And they walk around. Seriously, this is the thing that bothers me. They walk around like they're better than us. And I hate it because they are. Right? It's Minnesota Twins fans. Why we don't like them? Because they beat us for like 1,000 years in a row in the playoffs. And so, other thing, right? You feel like a cup full of puppies you love. Never heard anyone like high five someone like a cup full of snakes. Never. Like picking them like, whoa, this is so cute. Get a picture, cup full of snakes, right? But why is it that we can either like a group of people or like a thing, and other way we can dislike them and we don't even know why? Like, I don't know any Yankee players. If I became friends with Aaron Rodgers, I don't like the Packers, right? If I like met Aaron Rodgers, I'd probably be like his best friend because I'm super cool, right? And we'd want to hang out. He'd want to hang out with me. It'd be really great. And I'd probably like the Packers a lot, right? What is it about other people, other things, where we just don't like them? And I can tell you why. You have a value system. You have a way of doing things. And you believe that you are right. And you have your truth, and you have your values, and you have your experiences, and you have your money, and you have your time, and you have your vacation. You have these certain things. And if anyone is going to threaten that, if anyone's going to come and take it from you, if anyone's even going to question it, well, then you're going to want to protect that. If anyone's going to disrupt that flow, you're going to get like all worked up. Example, you have a neighbor. And your neighbor knows where the property line is, but they act like whenever they blow snow, they don't know where that property line is, right? And so they're blowing snow, and it goes over, and you look at it through your window, and you clench your fists, right? And you feel like, I want bad things to happen to that person. Why? That's my property, all right? I have the deed. That is my line. That's my snow. Don't interrupt my snow, right? Or how about this? Snowmobilers coming through like the beginning part of your lawn, right? And they drive over it, and you might get angry. You're like, I don't want to see those tracks. I'm going to never use that snow, but I don't want to look at it. I don't want anyone else using it. If I'm not using it, you're not using it. And in a distant way, it's confronting something that you hold to be true. So what do you do when that happens? What do you do as like a person with a fully developed brain? You walk over to a neighbor and you say, hey, friend, you know what? Like, you're blowing snow over here, and I want to hear your story. Tell me what you feel. Tell me what what's your dreams? And you sit down at the table, and you hold a mug that's warm like this, and you just do a lot of head nod, like, oh, and it's sideways because you're really interested. Oh, yes, tell me, right? And you come together with an agreement of how you're going to celebrate snow all together. That's how you do it, right? No! What do? You go to your wife, you go to your husband, you say, we're burning this house down, we're moving to Texas, right? We're never talking to them again. They are dead to us. That's usually how we do this. Think about this. We go to hockey games. You go to sporting events. Like, I go to, like, right now, sixth grade and third grade basketball games. It's riveting. I love it, right? But I went to the Section 7AA championship in hockey, and there was a time where the goalie got hurt. Now, this goalie is not, like, 32 years old, you know, a grown man. This is, like, a 16 or 17-year-old boy, right? And he gets hurt, and I heard one person just a little ways down cheer, like, yeah! I'm like, no, we don't do that, right? Or at games, people will yell or boo, like sixth grade kids playing basketball, like wanting them to fall down and cry. Why? So that we can win. We love to win. We love to win, and it feels good when we win. Why? Because it elevates us. So what do we do? When you have conflict, because you're going to have an enemy, you're going to have people that you do not agree with, you're going to have people, if you want to find out who your enemy is, get on Facebook and just write like something political, even just vaguely, right? And you're going to find out who you don't like instantly, right? You ever been there? So what are we supposed to do? If it's not blow up, if it's not disengage, if it's not run away, if it's not burn in the house, we never talk to anyone again, what are we supposed to do? Well, this is what we do. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. This is Jesus. Jesus had a few enemies along the way, just a couple, right? A couple 13, 14. And he's hanging on the cross. He's hanging on the cross. He is actively dying with each breath. And he looks down, and they're splitting up his clothes, right? His property. And he says, but Father, forgive them. They have no idea what they're doing. Even from a place of absolute death and certainty, all that stuff, he still leans towards what we call reconciliation. God's heart, who he is. It's not just what he does. It's not what the divine does. It's who the divine is reconciliation. And this is like Jesus-looking people look like Jesus. And what Jesus did is reconcile. Even when it was inconvenient, even when it wasn't fair, even when it was uncomfortable, even when it didn't make sense, he still said, this is what we're doing, reconciling. Reconciling people to God, to himself, reconciling people to people and people to the earth. It's in the Bible. This is what we do. And so when you have a neighbor who's blowing snow, when you have an employee that keeps stealing your credit for all the work that you did, make it their own, when you have a teenager who's disrespecting you, when you have a friend that is just making hard decisions, now it's affecting you, how you go about it, what do? It's reconciliation. But here's the problem. It just sucks. It does. It's really, really hard to reconcile. I never meet anyone who's really excited about reconciling. Wow, I can't wait till I can reconcile with my wife. That's going to be so much fun. We're going to talk for 2 hours and cry for another four, right? It's true. Why is it so hard? Well, I'll give you two reasons why it's so hard. First one is this, is reconciliation and power are two different things. For a lot of us, we associate reconciliation as power. Oh, the definition of reconciliation is by bringing wholeness. It's by restoring. It's by bringing it back to the place it was originally meant to be, which is love, which is friendship, which is respect, which is of healing. But power is where most of us start. If you are a parent here, or you've watched any like parent movies or movies with kids, a lot of people think reconciliation is by making your kid apologize to you. And honestly, there's times where that can be reconciliation. Hey, that's not how we do things around here, and this is how we do things around here. But a lot of times, right, even speaking for myself, reconciliation is about making sure that I'm right. And we've reconciled as long as you apologize and you say, I'll never do that again. Okay, good, now we're reconciled. Is it really reconciliation? Or is it just moving the person who has less power closer to me to make sure that I'm right, to make sure that I'm okay, to make sure that I'm validated and that you respect me as a father? Maybe you've been in an organization where this is the boss is never wrong. You've been around someone like that? And reconciliation is just, okay, yeah, I'm sorry. Yep, I'll get you that report. And they can walk away. You might have a friend, someone in your circle of friends where reconciliation, you can always tell. You know someone who has power when you finally say, I'm sorry, and the other person says, yeah, I'm sorry, but that's not reconciliation. But you really shouldn't have done that. But yeah, I'm really sorry. But you actually the one who really made me do this. I'm not in control of my own actions. You made me do this. Like we love power. But the thing is, the difference between power and reconciliation is about sitting down and being in that place with an actual human. It's about restoring and empowering and loving and bringing this wholeness together. Power, just you're going to get more power. Because power works, friends. It does. It works. And it's quick. And you get people to fall in line. And if you have the power, it's amazing, right? You say jump and they say, yes, I love to jump, right? But you know what you get more of then? You just get power. That's when your teenager begins just to stop listening to you and turns their heart off to you. It's when you can't keep the employees and they just cycle through over and over and over and over again. And when you have the power, you know what you can do? You can say, oh no, they're wrong. My teenager just is disrespectful. My employees, it's funny, the employees are always wrong. There's always something wrong with them and never to the boss. That's power. And power will get you what you want. You always winning. What I've seen is leads just to isolation. Reconciliation is about human connection. So I thought about this week I had to, getting ready for a message, and I got a call to do a funeral for a 25-year-old man, right? And it sucked. Met with the family and listening to them talk about how much they love their son, and I'm praying for them. I show up at the funeral and the visitation, and I'm with them, and I'm thinking all about reconciliation this week, and I want to reconcile their pain. And I think, in my mind, a real pastor has the power to reconcile that pain. If I was really a good pastor, if I was like the best one, I would have the perfect thing to say to them to reconcile, to bring wholeness to their grief. And I felt this pressure and this responsibility, and I realized I have no power. Watching someone cry over, like that's not supposed to happen. We're not supposed to have funerals for that, right? If you're a parent here and you had to bury your kid, I am so sorry. You know the only thing you can do for reconciliation in that moment is you have to sit in the pain with them. You have to give up your power. Because what we do, honestly, what we do in those situations to try reconciling it is by saying, oh, you know, God needed another angel. God needed another angel, and so he took him home. That is a lie. Because that picture of God is he's up there saying, dead, 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 me, me, me. What a horrible picture of God. That is not who he is. Reconciliation is me sitting and just crying with the family. It's me sitting after my car thinking, ooh, this sucks. That's giving up power, friends. That's what makes reconciliation so messy and so hard. The other thing is that makes it hard is that God clearly knows I'm right, right? In an argument, in a battle, in the blowing the snow, God, I follow God. Yes, praise you, Lord, right? So he's going to say, yes, of course your neighbor is the jerk and his snow is evil. Your snow is fine, but his snow is evil. And he's going to side with me. And when we walk around that way, we make it us versus them. We make it, I'm a follower of Jesus, so I'm the good guy. And I don't know, you go to the other church, and so you're the bad guy, right? Good snow, bad snow. And it's easy to think that way, that God loves me, doesn't like them. God will reward me, he'll punish them, which leads us to a fish. A fish, the story of Jonah. When you hear the word Jonah, you think of a fish, at least I do, right? And you start maybe even debating in your head, like, okay, yeah, it's a cute story. It's great. And did it really happen? Was there a fish? Is it just a story? And often that's where we stop and we miss out because the story, the fish is totally not even important. I apologize. If you have it like painted in your nursery, it's cute. I love it. That's not the point of the story. Not even close. Because there's something you need to know. Right? There's three verses. You want to throw those up there for Mr. Jonah? There's three verses in 2 Kings, and they talk about deporting, they talk about laid siege, and they talk about assault, and they talk about like slavery and imprisonment. Like those three words aren't in my top 20 of what I want for my life, right? I'm not a fan of any of those things. And these are the Israelites that were the recipients of this, and who did it to them was this group of people called the Assyrians. The Assyrians are like, we win, we're strong, we're going to hurt you, right? Like, I don't think that was their chant, right? That's not historical. Don't write it down. Won't make it into your paper. So the Israelites couldn't stand the Assyrians. So this guy named Jonah, he's out there walking around. God says, hey, Jonah, big fan of you and your work. I want you to go to Nineveh. And Jonah's response is not great. And why? Because Nineveh happens to be in Assyria. So you can imagine that he's not really excited about this. Why? Because it's us versus them, right versus wrong. We are the Israelites. We're God's chosen people, right? Genesis 12, to Abraham, he says, you're going to be a light to the whole world. We're the good guys. Yay, us. Assyrians, boo, hiss, right? So why would I go to them? God, you should just blow them off the map. You know what they did to us? You know what they did to my grandpa? You know what they did to my great-great-grandpa? So what does Jonah do? Jonah hops on a boat and he runs away, even though God clearly told him, you're going to go there because I want you to bring something good and beautiful to these people. And Jonah says, no. And what we teach our kids is, see, this is what happens when you disobey God and me. Right? If you disobey me, then there's a storm because all of a sudden there's a storm coming and he's on the boat and people are like, what's going on? All right? So don't disobey or storms happen in your life. You know, which is, you know, you can make an argument for that. But the Bible was written to a specific group of people at a specific time, and the Jonah was written to a group of people who were the Israelites, and they'd share this story, and you know what they would say when Jonah stood up and says, hey, God, no, they're evil and they're bad, so I'm not going to listen to you. I'm going on this boat, and you just need, clearly, God, you need some more time to think about your decision. The people that heard this would have been getting tattoos of Jonah on their arm, like, I got Jonah, look at it. You see how he smiles when I do this, all right? They would have been celebrating Jonah, high-fiving each other, giggling with each other. Oh, Jonah, 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 Jonah. Jonah masks, right? They would have had Jonah pajamas. They would love Jonah because he was sticking it to the Assyrians. Even though he's disobeying God, even though their God, Jonah says, no, he was a hero in that story. Everything's backwards. So Jonah hops on this boat, and he's down in the basement, or not, you know, it's not a basement. I'm a sailor. Don't worry. I got that lingo down. He's in the basement. And so the sailors who aren't even Israelites, who aren't like worshiping God, they begin to pray. You see how everything's backwards? Like the hero of the story who loves God says, no thanks God. And then he's in the basement while people who don't even worship God are praying, right? And they figure out, why is the storm? Oh, because the guy in the basement, he must have done something wrong. So they get him up and they're like, hey, we're gonna throw you off this boat, which is a, you know, good news of the gospel. So they throw him off the boat, and then of course, fish comes, 3 days. Hey, if you've never read the book of Jonah, it has some of the most intriguing, beautiful poetry in it, especially as he begins to sink. It is awesome. It is mind-blowing. So Jonah has a come-to-Jesus moment, and imagine that in the fish, right? And he comes back up, and he goes to the Syrians, goes to Nineveh, and he delivers this message that there's this good and beautiful God. And the way they respond is, yes, we want everything. Everything you're talking about, we want that. And they actually mourn. They actually mourn. And Jonah's still angry. He still doesn't get it. Actually, the book ends with a question. There's no like finality to it. Almost like the author of this story is trying to convey a message. And what's that message? What's the point of this story? It's that God loves everybody. Jonah kept on making about us versus them, right versus wrong, chosen people versus evil. And God says, I'm a big fan. I love them. And he loves both sides. There actually is no us versus them. There is no both sides. We want there to be, because why? Because it makes it so much easier. I don't have to reconcile with them because they're wrong. I'll reconcile with us because we just disagree, but we're okay. God says reconciliation in the kingdom looks completely different. Completely different. And I love this line. And sometimes your enemy may be more open to love and to grace than you are. The story of Jonah shows it. The Syrians, Nineveh was way more open to receive God's hope and mercy and love than Jonah. And they were the outsiders. So what do we learn from this? What we learn is this is who we are. This is who God is, and this is who we are. And I feel very passionately about this, because I deeply believe, if this is who God is, and we say we're Jesus-looking people, then you know if you are a follower of Jesus, you know if you're a disciple is the word they use in spiritual communities, you know if you're a Jesus-looking person, if you look like Jesus. This is one of those things we can, sometimes we can like say, well, that's a little gray, and I'm going to pick this part because it makes me feel good. I'm going to take this part because it makes me look awesome. All right, I'm going to ignore this part. This is one of those foundational truths as a Jesus-looking person is, can you love? And can you love differently? And can you actually reconcile? Can you move towards reconciliation? Can you get uncomfortable? And if part of you, because right, like I can just start name dropping some things or maybe even some people in this community and you might feel, right? Anytime you feel that negative effect, you feel that anger, you might look at a group of people. You might look at people of color and say, Black Lives Matter, just stop talking about it. Or we have a whole class about privilege. Just stop talking about it. We might talk about, we have one about finances and debt. Stop talking about it. Bring up if you feel that come up inside of you, it could be a threat. I won't lie to you, it could be a threat. But it is an invitation of heaven itself saying, I'm coming. Will you take me in? It is heaven calling out to you saying, now is the time, friend. Can you stumble through it? Because you don't have to, you're not going to kill it. You're not going to like just like reconcile and all of a sudden you're just perfect. No, you're going to stumble through racism. You're going to stumble through how you resent your teenager. You're going to stumble through why you're so angry. You're going to stumble through why you feel these violent tendencies. You're going to stumble through the mistakes you made. But that's all that God is asking you is just like lean into the kingdom. Just lean into it. It's funny, the more you lean into it, the more he'll lean into you, and the more that you're willing to receive, the more you're willing to grow. And the more you're willing to grow, the more love and beauty and hope. Then everything we talk about here, of life-giving conversations on every table in Carlton County, a good and beautiful life, becomes possible. You can't get away from this one. If you say you want to follow Jesus, then the way to it is the cross, my friends. It's the cross. So I got just to wrap up. Like my question, even though I was writing this, I'm like, okay, that sounds great. Like, yes, I want that. Please sign me up. Do I have to use the iPad? Is that what I'm doing now, right? Reconciliation, Chris Sauter, right? How do you do it? Here's four tips. Ways you can just lean into the conversation. And it's the first one is this. You have to start by surrendering to this kind of love. There's no way for the things that I've had to bring reconciliation to or pursue reconciliation. You have to start by surrendering to this kind of love. Meaning, it has to be supernatural. It has to be from God putting it in me to be able to love some people in my life. Because have you ever just tried harder to love them? You're like, hey, today's the day I'm just going to smile at my boss. And as he screams at me, I'm just going to say, I love this. Then I'll feel better, right? It doesn't work. You make it for like 5 seconds. It just doesn't work. You need to surrender that kind of love. And if the way of reconciliation is the cross, because that's a Jesus-looking God, is the cross. The only way to the resurrection, the only way to Easter, the only way to that new life is the cross. You have to surrender to it, friends. The second thing is this then, and it's actually in 1 Thessalonians. May the Lord make your love increase and overflow for each other and for everyone else, just as ours does for you. I love that verse. This is something that we should pray all the time. May like between Parps and I, may my love for you increase. And then I pray that every single client that you see at your business, I pray it overflows to everybody. I pray for in ESCO that my love for my neighbors is there, and I pray that it would spill out everywhere and it would like disrupt the life and the rhythm of ESCO itself. Why? Because love is so beautiful. It's something we have to pray. It doesn't happen by accident. Reconciliation does not happen just like, oh, hey, we're reconciled. That was awesome. Easy. So you have to surrender to love and then pray and ask God, God, will you put love in me for me and will you put it for everyone else? And the third thing then is you have to practice the art of losing. And this is super hard. I'm highly competitive. I don't want to lose at chutes and ladders, right? I don't. And my kids would win and I'm like, oh, flipping the board over and kicking in the air just to prove a point. No, I don't do that. It's a little aggressive. But we don't like to lose, right? And what do we say? Last time I checked, this is America, right? Yeah, these colors don't run. No, we don't run. We're tough. We win at all costs, but you have to lose. And not metaphorically, I mean really, you have to practice losing. Lose an argument. Lose an argument. Lose at sorry. Like, bet someone $5 to beat him in a race and then lose on purpose, right? Like, lose. Because if you want to lose, losing is another word for you have to get low. You have to deny yourself. You have to surrender. You just can't force it upon yourself. You have to practice it. You have to practice not always having the last word in the fight. You have to practice not always being right and correct and saying, oh, sorry, the comma goes here, Chris, not here, right? You have to lose. And losing feels like you're losing all of it. No, you know what? Like, your privilege is going to be right there. You owning the company, it's going to be right there. You being the parent, it's going to be right there. What I'm asking for just a moment is move it to the side. Because if you only see that person as, I'm going to beat you, I'm going to win, I'm going to prove how wrong you are, how right I am, you're seeing that opportunity. You're seeing them as a means to an end. And what's right in front of you, same thing Jonah did. He didn't see them as people deeply loved by the divine. Can you see your teenager like that? Can you see your spouse? Can you see your neighbor as someone who's deeply loved by God? You have to lose. And then lastly is give generously. When you get low, like Philippians 2, you can get low and then give the best of yourself. Give the best of your cookies, give you the best of your car, give the best of your living room, give the best of your words, the best of your dreams and your vision and your leadership, and sit at that table with them and give. Which is another way of saying love. There's never a downside to loving, friends. If we're willing to do those four things, it's not that simple. I don't want to say, oh, I just got to do this. It's not. But if we can, it helps us frame of, we can just lean in a little bit. And when you do that, friends, you're going to experience heaven. And what you felt like was an enemy, what you felt like will never talk again from what you did to me in junior high, there can be a dream of new life. So I'd like to end by reading something from Martin Luther King Jr. Returning hate for hate multiplies hate, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Hate multiplies hate. Violence multiplies violence. And toughness multiplies toughness. In a descending spiral of destruction, love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. We never get rid of an enemy by meeting hate with hate. We get rid of an enemy by getting rid of enmity. Please stand. Let's pray. So, Holy Spirit, we welcome you. And I ask that you would help us. Help doesn't even feel like the right word. I ask that you would deposit in us, that you'd lead us to this beautiful table, and would you serve us, would you feed us heaven, would you feed us a new kind of love, something so intense, something so much bigger, that we can take that and bring it to our neighbor, that we can take that and bring it to our kids, we can take that and bring it to our friend, we can take that and bring it to that coworker that we swear we never, ever connect with again. Because we need you. We need you. Will you forgive me? Will you forgive us? Where we've used hate and we've rationalized it, saying, well, God knows I'm right. God, forgive us. You help us lose the power. You help us get low, just push it to the side and say, help us see the people around us as like masterpieces of heaven. We want love more than fear. We want hope and healing more than just punishment. We want heaven versus hellish experiences to the people around us. You help us grow, help us evolve, help us love. Amen. So here's my invitation. We have people, what we call our ministry team. And if you're on the ministry team, if you mind, when coming up, we take time to pray with one another. Same thing we did with dedications. A group of people who are just standing with you and say, yeah, we're in this together. And there's three specific things that I feel like possibly God might be doing. The first one is this. You have the power. I said something and something came inside you and you felt like you're holding on to that power, maybe as a boss or a coworker or as a parent, and you realize you've been using it in a way that maybe you're not created to, but you don't know where to start. A great place to start is by saying, I don't know where to start, and the people up here can help and pray for you and walk you through it. Second thing is this, you need to reconcile. You know you need to reconcile. And a great place to start is coming up and saying, God, will you help me? Give me what I need. And the third one is this. You want to surrender to that love. You're like, I want that kind of love. I want that kingdom. I want that life in me. Man, there's nothing more. There's nothing more beautiful than when you say, yeah, I want that. And again, the people up here would love nothing more to pray for you. You want anything else for prayer? Come on up. We're going to worship for a little bit. Thank you for spending time with us at the Cloquet Vineyard. And thank you again for dedicating these beautiful kids.